The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to rock music historian Mark Blake, author of band biographies of Pink Floyd and Queen. His latest is Pretend You're in a War, The Who and the 60s. Stick around. How do you think he does it? I don't know. What makes this guy so good? So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you preferred to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that thought we were going to talk about The Who and the 90s, except that might leave us with a lot of dead air. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I read Pete Townsend's memoir, Who I Am, about a year ago, my interest in 1960s British rock icons fired up by Life, the compelling autobiography of Keith Richards. But whereas Richards' book astounded me with its stories of recall and the author's drug and alcohol-fueled insights into his own only-in-rock-and-roll craziness, I felt rather let down by Townsend's tale as early as the midpoint. I kept thinking Townsend needed a co-author to help him sort out his story, give it more humanity and emotion, and make it seem like he knew anything at all or cared about his longtime bandmates. Someone like Mark Blake. Blake, the author of Pink Floyd, Pigs Might Fly, and Is This the Real Life? The Untold Story of Queen, has just published Pretend You're in a War, The Who and the 60s. It's a kind of deep leap in the pool that I think The Who's lead guitarist wanted to produce, but fell woefully short on. Pretend You're in a War takes the first decade of The Who's 50-year career and gives context and breadth to behind-the-scenes detail that should electrify fans of one of the original world-class rock bands the genre has ever produced. Mark Blake, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi.
Hey there. Mark, let's start right at the top with the title, Pretend You're in a War. Can you explain that to people?
Yeah, it's a title. It's something that Pete Townsend was asked in an interview, I think it was an interview around about 1966, was asked how he prepared for going on stage with The who obviously at that point had a reputation for smashing guitars and a very aggressive performance, and he answered, Pretend You're in a War. And it's in an interview that very rarely gets repeated anywhere else, and I sort of came across it, wrote it down, and decided that when I did a book about The Who, that was the title I was going to use for it. So that's where it came from. It's one of Townsend's own quotes.
That Townsend guy is getting his face in here a lot, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of his early life, as a matter of fact, from what I read of his book, a lot of his life has been very embattled. So, I mean, it's kind of like he's almost felt like he's been at war his whole life, whether he actually has been with anyone.
Yeah, I think the war and the legacy of the Second World War is a thing that really hangs over his songwriting. He was born literally just as the war was ending. This stuff about the war in Tommy. It's a real theme in the Who's music and in Townsend's music. He came out of that generation where, you know, their parents and grandparents and families and friends, you know, there's a whole adult generation who'd been through this a terrible war here in the UK, you know. Growing up with bombs going off, their lives destroyed. And that seemed to be a big shadow over his childhood. And I think a lot of those kind of post-war British rock musicians. But to attend.
It seemed like the United States participated in World War II, obviously. They had a big role there. Although, according to the Soviets, they apparently were very important in the war, but what I'm getting at is, I don't think that Americans have the same sense. Americans from that same era, same generation as Pete and Roger, because the bombs weren't going off over here, they weren't under daily threat.
No,
it was a different sense. After post-war in the United States was grow. You know, it was you know, it's thought of as a very happy time, but post-war UK, very different situation. And I think that's one of the things that did come across well in his book, and it comes across very clearly, I think, in your book as well.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a difference there. You know, even for my parents and grandparents who are all gone now, but even listening to their stories when I was a child about what you kind of went through growing up in London, and some of them actually stayed living in the heart of London while the Blitz and so on was going on. It was an extraordinary time. It's very hard to explain it to my generation. No sort of pun intended there, and also to, you know, my. Trying to explain it to my son, you know, recently as well, and saying, look, you know, you could go to bed at night and suddenly an air raid siren would go off. You would have to get out of your house and go to the nearest tube station, underground train station, and stay in there for the next 6 or 7 hours. And when you came out, your house might have been destroyed and people you might know would have died. And that's very hard for me to get my head around. And I'm quite old now. And it's, you know, it's going to be harder still for other generations. And it really comes to the surface when you talk to Townsend and Daltrey about their childhoods. You know, I know way before I did this book, talking to Roger Daltrey about this, and, you know, he couldn't impress on me enough what it was like growing up with that, you know, looming over you.
We, my family and I were in London for the first time 2 years ago, the summer, and went to the Churchill Museum and went to other historic sites. And really, it is, you know, we've seen the film of that era. We've seen the buildings, we've seen the blackout nights, the bombed out. But you just can't put your, if you see modern London, you just can't imagine. And I know that Berlin is like that too. You just can't imagine the devastation that went on. All right, so I'm getting us a little off the mark here. I know people want to hear us talk about the Who. What actually got you interested in doing a history of the Who?
I think it was, I'd interviewed Daltrey several times, and, you know, I'd done, as he's mentioned earlier, I did the book about Queen and the book about Floyd. I think the Who's story is very messy. It's a really messy kind of story. They're a messy band. They don't do anything easily. They don't do anything the way people think they should do it. And that's part of the charm. They never split up. You know, they didn't sort of discreetly wait for the drummer dies in Led Zeppelin, they stop. The drummer dies in The Who, they get another drummer and carry on. And you know, I remember going to see them in the early 80s. And it's worth pointing out, people now absolutely slag off that period in The Who's career. But, you know, I saw them playing in Wembley and big venues. And you know, at the time, they went over really well. You look back retrospectively and, yeah, it's not Keith Moon. But, you know, I think what it was is that The Who, a bit like Pink Floyd, a bit like Queen, certainly like Led Zeppelin, in my adult lifetime, they've been huge bands. They've been slightly remote. They've been big, big giants of music. And the further we get on with this, and they're celebrating 50 years, the further we get away from that, the more interested I am in what they were like before they were famous, before they were the biggest bands in the world. And it's that period, and I found this during the Pink Floyd story, you find out what they were like as teenagers and early on, you get a very good picture of why they are the way they are now. And I think with The Who, particularly with Townsend, it's really, really obvious. So once I started digging around a bit in their past and finding people that had grown up with them, I realized that it started to fill in the blanks and you discover why The Who are the way they are. And I thought it was interesting. It's really famous people before they were famous. That's the appeal.
I'm looking for a point in my notes because you mentioned the people that they knew when they were in high school and stuff, and that people in their very early days. I guess these are people once they started forming bands, but Dave Golding and Doug Sandham, John Scholar, Helmut Gordon. That was really fun to get that kind of detail. And who among these people? I want to come back to Daltrey and Townsend in a second, but who among this group that you interviewed and detailed, you know, was most interesting, and do you think doesn't get enough credit for even indirectly?
I don't think there's anyone that's been missed out in terms of getting credit, because I think those guys, I mean, Helmut Gordon's dead now, and he has been, I think, for quite some time. But, you know, the people like Doug Sandham, who played drums, you know, Doug's now in his 80s. You know, he was their drummer when they were just fresh out of school, and they weren't The Who then. They were called The Detours. They were playing all the little pubs, youth clubs, wedding receptions, doing the hits of the day, wearing suits and playing other people's songs. It wasn't The Who, but Doug was their drummer. I think Doug was a very interesting guy to talk to, because also he lied about his age. He was a little bit economical with the truth. They knew he was a bit older than them, but they didn't know he was 13 years older. And, you know, so he was a guy in his early 30s looking after a bunch of 17, 18-year-old tearaways. And Doug was perfectly capable of handling himself as well. And I think Doug's an interesting part of that story. You mentioned Dave Golding. Well, Dave was a guy who played drums after Doug was sacked just for a few shows before Keith Moon joined. But he was there the night Keith came down to a pub in West London and sort of asked to play on the kit in the interval. And there's always been a lot of stories about whether this actually happened. But Dave's a guy in his 70s who still plays drums. I think he plays in jazz or big band groups. And, you know, he took the phone call and just said, look, you know, this was just another day for me, another gig. You know, he didn't think Keith Moon was very good, you know. And it's great to get that kind of perspective. And, you know, he's not a guy that's been trading on being in The Who for 50 years. You know, as far as he was concerned, he was a temporary drummer. But those guys will tell you stuff. They'll have something interesting to say about what Daltrey and Townsend and the rest were like when they were like 17, 18. So I don't think there's anyone in that story that hasn't been given enough credit of those guys that were around at the time. But they're always illuminating. They'll always have something to tell you.
There's no Pete Best in The Who's... Sorry.
I don't think so, because I think, you know, Doug was a very different sort of drummer by those all accounts. And if you listen to those early Who records, those singles, what makes it is the four of them, and that means Keith Moon. Keith Moon's way of drumming, like a lead instrument. If you strip that out of those songs, it would sound very, very different. So, you know, they were close to getting a recording contract, and the story is that, you know, the management and the record company wanted rid of Doug. But you could argue, I don't think The Who would have been as successful as they were without those four people. It was that combination with Moon as well. That's what really made it work. That's what made them take off.
I love the multiple examples of Keith Moon destroying drum kits all over the landscape.
Simply. Yeah.
he was not exactly winning over people.
No, he wasn't. No, and I mean, a lot of this, I think later on he sort of assumed a persona and became trapped in a persona. I mean, there's a whole other story really with Keith Moon. But again, going back to people that knew him very, very early on at school and in the groups he played with before The Who, they will tell you that, you know, he had that side to his character even then. You know, there was definitely a streak in his personality that was a little strange. A little violent, but it just seemed to become amplified the bigger he got and the bigger The Who got and the more famous he became. He ended up kind of living up to it, I think.
You mentioned that you had spent a lot of time interviewing Daltrey. And what is he like to be around?
He's exactly like you would imagine, in a way. I mean, he's a pretty bluff, straight-talking guy, doesn't suffer fools gladly. I think he's a huge Pete Townsend fan. I think he's a huge Who fan. And, you know, the first time I interviewed him was at a time when I don't think relations between him and Townsend were that great. You know, the Who were during one of their sort of periodic kind of lulls. And he was good value. You know, he's enormously respectful of Townsend as a songwriter. I think he's been a good ally to him. I think Roger gets a rough end of the stick sometimes. I think he's had a lot more to do with the Who's success than he's sometimes given credit for.
Can you compare the two of them as a team to, you know, Jagger and Richards and Lennon McCartney? Is it the same type of relationship, or is it?
No, I think it's different. I always think, in a way, it's been a bit more standoffish. I mean, it's funny. I was reading Philip Norman's book about Mick Jagger recently, and there's great stories in there about when Jagger and Richards and Brian Jones were all living together in some squalid little house in West London, and they used to sort of share a bed because they had no money for the gas meter, for the heating. And, you know, I don't think Townsend and Daughtry ever had that relationship. It was always a bit more standoffish because Daughtry's a year older than Townsend. They've both been at the same school together. But Daughtry was quite feared at his school. And when you're 15, 16, and there's a guy that's 17 who's been expelled, who's well known for being quite handy with his fists, there's a wariness. You carry on that wariness, I think, even into young adulthood. So I think Entwistle and Townsend were always a bit wary of Daughtry. And I think, you know, the balance of power shifted later. But no, I don't think there was ever the coziness that I think perhaps there once was, certainly with Lennon and McCartney at the beginning, but no, it's not quite the same.
Daughtry seemed to always be the one to get the girl, too.
Well, a lot.
Girls,
I think
girls.
Girls, oh yeah, definitely plural. That's the whole book in itself.
That would be a great book. I'd read that.
There's
book.
A lot of things, there's a lot of stories didn't make it into the book. You know, Daughtry didn't take drugs. He didn't smash up hotel rooms, and, you know, I don't think he was ever a massive drinker. So, you know, he had other hobbies to keep himself occupied with when they were playing pubs, you know, in London. He kept busy in his own way.
I was going to say, if I lived to be 70, which who knows if that'll happen, I would love to suddenly be built like Roger Daughtry. How on earth that man has just looks the way he looks. I mean, I'm not interested in men, but you cannot help but admire a guy who is just rock solid abs.
He's still got the remains of a six pack, hasn't he? I think he had a photo with his shoulder. He looked after himself. I mean, I remember seeing footage in the early 80s on a TV news program here, and it was showing him doing his workout, you know, in a gym. And this is a time when you never saw a rock star or a pop star anywhere near a gym. You know, it was unheard of, you know, at that time. Now they're all at it, but, you know. No, he's just looked after himself over the years. He takes it very seriously, looking after the voice.
And then Pete, the opposite end of that, has never really taken care of himself.
No.
You know, hasn't abused himself to the degree that Keith Richards has.
No.
But here, these are the last men standing in the band, and they have completely – it's like if you interviewed the 113-year-old woman and you say, what do you attribute your long life to? Cigar every day, whiskey.
That's it. Yeah. Well, I mean, I know Townsend's teetotal and has been for many years now. But it is strange that they are the last men standing.
Now, you could have written about a number of periods in the Who's history. I mean, they've been around for 50 years. Did you do the 60s as a precursor to, will we get a book on the 70s next, or are you done with them?
I think I'm done with them. I'd love to do a book on the 70s, or I'd love to, you know, bring the story up to date. I don't know if there's, in the current climate, whether there'd be enough interest necessarily in that. Originally, we were going to do the whole 50 years, but kind of feeling was, if you want to bring something really new to the story, let's go. I wanted to go for the early years. And obviously the involvement of Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, their first managers, is a real big part of the book. That was one of the things that inspired me to do the 60s, because I was fascinated by these two guys that, you know, had been such a big part of the story.
Well, the band's creative output, I hate to hurt anybody's feelings, but the last 20 or 25 years, the creative output has not been what it was the first 25 years. Anyone should expect that it would be, but I think in Townsend's book, I think he tries really hard to make the case that, you know, he's been just as creative and just as productive in the second half of that 50 years. And I don't think you can make that case.
No, I mean, they stopped recording as The Who. I mean, if you think, what was it? They did Endless Wire in the 2000s, and that was the first studio album since 82. But yeah, I think Townsend, like anyone, I mean, it's a bit, to some extent, even like possibly McCartney, faces the same thing. I mean, you know, Townsend has never toured as a solo act the way McCartney has, but he's all, both of them are in the shadow of what they did as younger men. I think it's just unavoidable. You know, it's the same if you're Pink Floyd, it's the same if you're the members of Queen, it's the same if you're Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin. You know, you're responsible for this body of work that early on. It's really hard to shake that off.
Well, no one expected when rock and roll was hitting its stride in the 50s and the 60s that this was a long-term career option. This was
absolutely not.
This for a few years, and then hopefully maybe that art school education will kick in, or you'll become an engineer, or maybe, you know, maybe you'll make, I don't think anyone recording in the early 60s, short of maybe the Beatles, was thinking, okay, we'll be able to live off of these, you know, recording royalties for the rest of our lives. They couldn't have foreseen, in the case of The Who, that in the 90s there'd be a TV series, CSI, that would use their music and make them a thing to a whole new generation. Or Paul McCartney would go out and continue to tour, you know, even by himself. This gets off the subject of the 60s, I guess, but what do you owe the longevity to? What do you owe – I'm sorry, I'm not asking this well. To what do you think The Who owes its longevity at this point?
I think it's to do with the songs. I think the songs have held up well, all those – groups that you've mentioned as well. You take the songs out of the equation, you've got very little. The songs are there and the public interest is still there. So when The Who did get back together at various points, they could always do arenas and stadiums. They never ended up playing the small theatres. I think with The Who, and as it is with Zeppelin, it's interesting at the moment. The Stones. The Who, as with The Stones, they're both on tour sort of at the moment, both trekking around America. It's almost like they don't quite know when to stop or what happens when you stop. Because what happens when you stop, when you actually say, right, that is it, there's no more, suddenly you're an ex-rock star. I don't know. Does the interest go away? What happens? And I think Townsend's a very restless character. Seems like a very restless character. He's a creative guy, as you said earlier. He keeps writing music, keeps wanting to do things, whether it was good as what he's done before is neither here nor there. And I think longevity is down to that. They're restless. They don't want to stop. They don't want to face up to it. That you know, it's time to end. And I think what will do for them at the end of the day is their bodies will tell them it's time to stop. Yeah, something is happening in this Who 50 tour is that Daughtry's had to cancel shows or postpone shows because of his voice, you know. And I think that's the reality when you're 71 years old, that maybe this shit's going to start happening now. You know?
I mean, there is no precedent for this. I mean, Sinatra kept singing till almost a few years before the end, but it's a different kind of – I mean, he'd go out there in his three-piece suit.
Absolutely.
You know, he'd just stand still. Maybe he'd walk a little over here. He'd walk a little over there. He'd talk to some sweet little old lady in the front row. I mean, when Daltrey or Jagger goes out on the stage, I mean, you get every – they drip all over the audience. They give every drop of what they have. It's an extraordinary kind of thing. If the 60s has been the most interesting era for the band, what's been the least interesting?
Probably the 80s. But even then, I find the 80s interesting. I find watching it fall apart kind of interesting. it's got a car crash quality to it. But then, again, like I think it's like I said at the beginning when we were talking, you know, we're very harsh on that decade with hindsight. Because you look back and maybe the fashions and Townsend's kind of combing his hair up and trying to hide the fact that he's losing it a little. And they're guys in their late 30s, early 40s who feel they need to still look young, you know. Now, those guys can go on stage. It doesn't matter. You can go on stage with gray hair, with a shaved head, wearing a suit. You know, they're not trying to keep up anymore. So the 80s is the least interesting in some ways musically. But in other ways, it's kind of fascinating to me.
And who do you think in the band, along that same thing, who do you find to be the most interesting and the least interesting? And that can include the members who have gone on, you know, passed, obviously.
I don't know, really. I've found all of them interesting. But John Entwistle's the least famous maybe perhaps the least well-known member of The Who to people that don't know much about The Who. They're going to know who the other three are. They're not going to know John Entwistle. But John Entwistle was a fascinating guy. And I think there's a good story there. You know, it's the idea that he was the quiet member of the band just isn't necessarily the case. So I'd say that rather than the least interesting, certainly the most unsung member of the band is Entwistle. And definitely in the wider world.
Do you think we know everything there is to know about Entwistle, and we still
No, not necessarily.
He's a very private man.
He was a private man, but you know, it wasn't until he died that people realized the extent of his financial troubles that he was in. You know, which is one of the reasons The Who reformed and played tours was to dig him out of a hole financially. Don't think people necessarily knew the extent of the drug problems that he'd had and drink problems, you know. But by that stage in the game, by the 90s and the 2000s, you know, Daltrey and Townsend were both in a good place, you know, and Daltrey never had his demons the way the others did. But I think it was something quite sad, I think, about the fact that Entwistle was in the mess that he was in at the end. You kind of felt he should have been in a better place at that stage.
I was going to say, you would think, having been on the ride, been along for the ride for all those years, even though he was not writing the music, that he would have been in better shape.
Well, I think he spent more than he was living beyond his means. He had a sort of mansion that was a real... If you thought of in your mind of what a rock star's mansion would be like, that was John Entwistle's house, his suits of armour in the hallway and so on. And I remember doing an interview with him in the 90s, and he said, for me to continue to maintain this fucking ridiculous standard of living, I have to keep working with The Who. And that's, I remember him saying that. And at the time, you could see that that's, you know, what he had to do. So, I don't think they made the money. They didn't make the money the way the Stones made the money, not early on.
No, later they certainly did.
Later they did, yeah.
It's been coming come around there. Mm. I mentioned in the introduction that one of the things that kind of drove me nuts about reading Pete Townsend's memoir is that for a guy who seems so fueled by emotion in his music and on stage, he captured very little of that in his own book. I just didn't feel – I mean, you know, you get past the issues with his grandmother and some of those kind of things, but you don't get – I really got a sense that he didn't even know the guys that he'd been playing with all these years. Or he was afraid to share, but it, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I was aware of with that book is that there was about over 100,000 words was cut out of it from his original manuscript. So there was a serious editing job that had to be done on that. Townsend's talked about this himself. So I think what you ended up with in a manageable book was only a fraction of the story. And I think there's whole chapters and whole characters, and maybe the kind of the edited out material would probably have filled in a lot more of those blanks. I certainly felt that reading it, that it jumped about a little, and I thought you could tell things have been cut out, things have been missed. But I think it's because he's very prolific. He wrote the book, he was writing it on and off for years, and obviously presented them with a gigantic manuscript that then had to be turned into something a lot more manageable.
But if there's 100,000 words of Pete talking about The Who out there, that's really interesting, that gives you what was missing in Who I Am, wouldn't you think someone would release that?
Well, it depends if he wants it out there. I don't know. You know, you're tied into all sorts of contracts with the publishers. I mean, you know, with a book like that, you're aiming for what, like you said earlier, the Keith Richards life, that market. You're aiming to sell to people who maybe own the greatest hits of The Who, or maybe don't even own anything at all, but are interested because of Townsend's fame and that personality. So,
well, I mean, I think the thing about the Keith Richards book when it came out is that it's like, oh, Keith Richards is writing an autobiography. It'll probably be about 25 pages, you know, because what's he going to remember? Now, I'm sure that he had help. He doesn't credit any particular.
He does have help. There was a ghostwriter in there, yeah.
Right, but it's still astonishing what the ghost got out of him, what Keith got out of him. And I mean, I make my living writing these collaborative books where I work with people and tell their story. And one person can't remember every detail of their story. You have to go out and talk to other people. You have to confirm things. But who would have expected that Keith Richards' book would have set a standard for what you would want and what you would expect? And then Pete's book comes along, and it falls it falls far short of that. And Pete is the guy who likes to talk, who likes to let you know that he was the editor of an imprint, and he, you know, and he just didn't deliver. And I'm sorry, I really like the man's his musical output. Some of it, you know, the stuff with the Who, some of the solo stuff, some incredible music. But I just thought, you know, how could you fall short on your own story? With your publishing background, with your music background, and I just thought it felt short. I suspect that the 100,000 words that was cut was a lot of blather, frankly, because so much blather got
been.
In.
Yeah, may well have been. Yeah, but we'll never know because I'd like to get hold of those. I'd like to have read those 100,000 words, but no, I don't. I don't know what happened to it. But yeah, I think it did. I agree with you that it fell short. Definitely, you're certainly not the first person to say that about that book.
I'm going to put in my vote for you to get your hands on that and shape it up and release it.
Because tell him. Yeah, tell Townsend I should do that.
There you go. I'm on the record. These kind of books they need a real professional writer's touch to bring out certain things and to point out where the flaws are, I think. Of course, I'm a little prejudiced in that myself. The Who continued to, no matter what happened, Keith Moon dies, John Entwistle dies, they keep performing, they keep coming back to it. Rolling Stone's still out on the road. The Beatles never reformed as the Beatles, but they remained in contact. They still, you know, they work together as friends, that kind of thing. Why do you suppose this other band that you wrote about, Queen, they lost their lead singer, certainly the heart and soul of the band in many ways, although some might argue maybe Brian May. Why has Queen never been able to replace Freddie Mercury and get back out consistently on tour and do what they do? It's such an incredible story, such amazing music. Is it just... was it just too much to overcome, the loss?
I think originally, yeah, it was too much to overcome. I think they were – I mean, they're touring now, or they've toured recently with Adam Lambert, haven't they, the guy from American Idol. And I think they're much more settled and happy doing it with him, but it's taken them this long – to do it. And I think they were all in shock for a little while. It's kind of, what do we do now? You know, I remember going to that Freddie Mercury tribute concert they did at Wembley, and they were sort of stood around on stage, the three of them, and they did look a little bit lost, which is completely understandable. So, you know, I don't think they knew what to do. They all made solo albums, didn't they? Brian May and Roger Taylor did all made solo albums. I can't remember the names of most of them. You know, but they're both songwriters. They both wanted to keep doing stuff. But how do you replace Freddie Mercury? That's the thing, I think. And, you know, certainly the attempt with Paul Rogers to do something, I thought fell very flat, really. And the studio album was appalling, really. It was just so incredibly average, you know, just nothing, you know.
There's just a certain magic, I guess.
It's a chemistry. I think it's that chemistry thing that we talked about earlier, you know, with the difference of having Keith Moon in The Who rather than Doug, you know. So that's it.
Speaking of Keith, I don't want to skip over him so much. People who came to The Who, you know, after, say, 1970, like in the last 45 years.
Yeah.
You know, they had another drummer. Why is he important to the band's, even, you know, to its legacy? Why is he so important?
Well, I think the personality and the stories definitely did a great deal to raise The Who's reputation. I mean, as a kid growing up in the early 70s, I can remember seeing Keith Moon's name in newspapers before I really knew what The Who was. I kind of have this memory of being about 6 or 7 and knowing that Keith Moon was a sort of a byword for some sort of excessive behavior. And that was Keith Moon was the first person I ever heard of anything to do with The Who. And I think he kept that reputation alive. He did a lot for that reputation, but his contribution in the studio and on stage, again, it's the music, it's how he played and the way he played with Entwistle. You don't have to be a musicologist to understand what they're doing. I couldn't understand what they're doing. I think this is the thing I said in the book. They played sort of upside down and back to front. That's the only way to describe it in layman's terms, but it absolutely worked. It gives those early records, well, all of those records, it gives them that drive and that energy, which is such a part of The Who's sound.
What, Mark, as you went into researching this book, by the way, how long did it take to put this book together?
It felt like a lifetime. I can't remember.
Doesn't every book feel like a lifetime? Yeah,
this one really did. Yeah, it took me longer than it should have done, as my bank manager would confirm. It was a while. I mean, I did a lot of work and then I stopped and did some other stuff on it. So the actual writing process would have taken well over 6 months, the actual physical writing, but then there's rewriting and editing. But there's a lot of interview work in interviews I did way before, early on.
And in the interview process and the research process, what kind of things did you find that you did not expect to hear? Was there a story or two that particularly stands out for you that you went, wow, I've got to share this with people?
Let me think. It was probably, I think, yeah, you've stumped me there because I can't actually remember what any of them specifically were. But I think how much of their characters were kind of set in stone early on. You know, speak to the guy that was at school with them, will tell you stuff about Daltrey, and you just it completely ties in with the image that you have of the guy now. And this was at 14 or 15 years of age. So it's that kind of stuff. I think as well, now I'll tell you what, I think the thing that comes to mind, and it's not just with the Who, it'd be the same with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, how much everybody was just making it up as they went along. You know, you see huge bands now earning all this money, playing these stadiums. Really, it's just a couple of blokes in a garage. It's never that far from a couple of blokes in the garage. And that's not to put down the creativity and the songwriting, all the rest of it. But they started with no map, no rules. You know, everybody was muddling through, their managers, their record companies, and the bands themselves. And I think the other thing that was a real reminder was that if you didn't write your own songs in the 60s after Lennon and McCartney came along, that changed the landscape. You were finished. And that was an interesting thing. You had all these bands that were just ticking along, going out, playing clubs. Suddenly, you had to write your own songs because Lennon and McCartney changed that. Obviously, you had a Pete Townsend in The Who. You had a Jagger Richards in The Stones. So those bands are okay. But you talk to other groups that were around at that time and they just said, we were finished. We knew we were finished. We tried to write. We just knew we couldn't do what Townsend was doing. You know, that comes across. I think I'd underestimated how important that was until I heard about it at that time.
Well, you fed into my next question. I wondered if you had a favorite Who song from the 60s and if it was different now than before you started the book.
Oh, I Can See for Miles, I think. Yeah, I'd say that's definitely one of my favorites from that period. Yeah, let's go for I Can See from Mars. I think I liked it before, and I still do now. Yeah, absolutely. And Pictures of Lily, you know.
Well, Townsend, yeah. One of his many talents certainly is, it's a complete composition, but there's also, he could just hear, I guess, it in his head, like a line that would just, How do you think he does that? I mean, I can see for miles a teenage wasteland. You know, these are things that one person is lucky to have one good line in their life. Mm. And he, 20, 30, 40, who knows?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
They just really click for people.
Mm.
So, all right. So as we kind of wrap up, you've written books on The Who, Pink Floyd, Queen. You've edited books, The Wit and Wisdom of Keith Richards. I want to get my hands on that.
Okay.
I assume it's more than a pamphlet.
Not much more, but yeah.
And
you can buy it on Amazon for a penny at the moment, one English P. So,
oh, we try not to talk about the low end of the prices on Amazon.
Okay.
I just had a book reissued. It came out in a beautiful new edition, and someone says, "Why would I want to buy that when I can buy the original for about 5 cents on Amazon?"
Yeah, great. Yeah,
thanks.
I feel your pain.
Yeah. So what's next? I mean, you have not done a book on the Beatles. You have not done a book on Led Zeppelin. Any interest in going those directions, or is that well trod?
Well, I think I think one of the problems now is that they're all well trod. I think you've got to look for a different angle on books if you're going to do that, which is why I did The Who in the 60s. So I'm not quite sure what would be my next project. I have got something possibly in the pipeline, but it's a bit too early to tell. But I think when you're looking at bands with this huge history like these guys, you've got to look at it from a fresh perspective. I think that's the important thing to do and find something new to say about it. And that's not always easy.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can find Mark Blake's latest You Are There Rock History, Pretend You're in a War, The Who and the 60s, as well as his earlier books, Pink Floyd, Pigs Might Fly, and Is This the Real Life? The Untold Story of Queen, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And if you, if you're on the website, MrMedia.com, to the left or to the right, underneath the video, you will see the covers of these books. You can just click on them right now, and if you're in an area that Amazon serves, hell, they'll get it to you by drone in 30 minutes or less. I don't know, that's what I hear. I don't know if that's true. But, you know, the books are available, I'm sure, as e-books, as print books. You can have them as an e-book, you know, within minutes, a physical book, you know, within days. Go ahead and order them. This is a real – if you love The Who, if you're interested in British rock in particular, you will enjoy this book. The detail is astounding. Mark, are you a web guy? Is there a website? Are you on Facebook, Twitter? How can people?
Yeah, I'm on all of those things. All of those things. I've got a website, www.markrblake.com, and I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter as MarkBlake3. So yeah, I'm there.
Two Mark Blakes ahead of you. I don't think that's right.
Yeah, I know. I don't. Yeah, no idea who they are.
Can I say that they should bugger off? Is that okay?
Yeah, you can. That is a good. That's a good English colloquialism. It's in keeping with the book. Yeah,
I'm trying to fit in where I can. What can I?
Oh, yeah, it's working. It's good. It's
I
good.
Won't try to do any kind of a British accent, but I might use a little language here and there.
No, do.
Thank you, Mark Blake. Thank you so much for the book, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. No, I think we're good to go. If you want to, yeah, I'll try and keep my answers fairly brief and try not to ramble too much.
No. You talk as much as you want. People are tuning in to hear you. They don't give a crap about me.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, the reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WABA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.